Welcome to All Autism Talk, connecting the autism community one podcast at a time. Our podcast offers friendly conversations with inspiring individuals in the autism community. All Autism Talk is brought to you by Learn Behavioral and the Learn Provider Network. Now here's your host.
Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. One thing to know about All Autism Talk is that our podcast is committed to offering a meaningful conversation to the entire autism community. It's important for us to hear all voices, whether that be from an individual with autism, a parent, a caregiver, or researchers and practitioners as we've had on in the past. This week, I was really excited to sit down with Arfa Alam. Arfa Alam is a first-generation Muslim American with close ties to the differently abled community. She has experience working in a nonprofit that partners with federal governments to advocate for human rights, and she also has two children on the autism spectrum. And she shares a unique story about the beginning of COVID, some general life stressors, and how that changes and gets even more stressful when you add in the diagnosis of autism. And can I just say, she's a wonderful lady. She had a great conversation. She's so easy to speak with, and I hope you learn from her story as I did. Arfa, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
I think we've got a really interesting topic for today about inclusivity and dignity. But before we dive into that, I'm so curious about your backstory as a first-generation Muslim American and how you kind of became connected to the world of different abilities.
Yeah, thank you so much again, Richie, for having me. And I'm happy to share that story with you and the audience here today. So for me, different abilities or disabilities have been a part of my life since before I was even born, since the womb, because I was born with a twin sister who is deaf and also has learning disabilities. So she was the first person in my life who ever taught me about this. Of course, back then it wasn't called different abilities. Back then people just said like, oh, she's deaf and she has a disability. And I also think back then, I mean, this was, you know, full disclosure, I'm 37 years old. So in the late 80s, early 90s, I remember even as a child when professionals would talk about her deafness or the learning disabilities she had, it was in a very doom and gloom way. But to me, I never saw it that way. Yes, disability is a very real thing, but I saw so much more than that when I saw my sister. And just from a really young age, she taught me and my siblings so much about empathy and compassion and giving others grace, but also about the need for inclusivity. Again, as little kids, we weren't calling it that, right? But how much of a way society still needs to go to achieve true inclusivity, and how we as neurotypical siblings of hers, how we could advocate and be allies.
It's so interesting that that story started for you at such a young age. I mean, I think back, I'll pretend for this conversation that I'm 37 also, and I'll also relate to the late 80s and say that that was a different time, right? The language, the verbiage was different. The inclusivity of the time was different. Great historical context, I think, because not everyone understands necessarily where we've been or where we're heading.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only was the language different, but the way people were treated. I mean, this wasn't that long ago, you know, I'm a millennial, right? That this wasn't that long ago, but people like my sister were treated less than human. I mean, unfortunately, some of that still exists. But when I look at my children's school today and the awareness and acceptance that exists today, it's like night and day compared to that time.
Yeah, it's amazing. So how did you get into, so she was born deaf and with a learning disability. How did you get into the autism community? How did you get involved in that community?
Yeah, so that is an interesting one. You know, growing up, I thought, so again, because of my sister's deafness, I always gravitated towards, you know, being or trying to be an ally towards the differently abled community. I was in Best Buddies, which is a national organization that you know, encourages relationship building and allyship between differently abled and neurotypical individuals. I joined that from the time I was in middle school, did that throughout a college, and then even as I started my young professional career, I was always plugged into that space. But I never imagined that as I got older, just how much more deeply these issues would impact me. And then the pandemic happened. This was March 2020. I was at home. I still remember vividly the day everything shut down in the DC area, which is where I'm based. I was at home with a 1-month-old, and my then 2-year-old had just been diagnosed with autism. My then four-year-old, she was about to be diagnosed with epilepsy, and she, thank God, has grown out of it since then. And my husband had also recently been diagnosed with a chronic illness, early onset Parkinson's disease, which is, you know, exceedingly rare for young people in their 30s to be diagnosed with. So at that point, I had resigned from my job, and I was 100% committed to my family, and was just like threw myself into research for getting everyone in my family the services and the help that they needed. And of course, like top of my mind at that time was my 2-year-old's autism. And by the way, the child who was a newborn on at that time, he also went on to be diagnosed with autism when he was about 14 months old. But, you know, the pandemic had just started. Everything was shut down. And I was like, okay, what do I do? So I used to literally spend my nights researching things online. And I found a couple of things that helped me right away. One of them is there, you may have heard of her, Dr. Mary Barbera. She is a BCBA. She has quite a following online, and she offers a number of courses that teach parents how to do ABA at home with their children. So the very first thing actually I did was I took a few of her courses, and I started ABA at home with my 2-year-old. I still have some video recordings of those early days.
Wow.
Through the process of taking those courses, I learned about the history of ABA and how problematic the history of ABA really is, if I'm being honest, right? I believe that the ABA that both of my sons have benefited from so tremendously, it is very different from the ABA that I think a lot of autistic adults speak out against, and rightfully so. But anyways, we can maybe get back to that in a minute. Going back to what I did and how I eventually came to the world of learned behavioral, I signed up for that ABA course. I also found this amazing free resource called I Love ABA. It's a blog that was run by this amazing BCBA named Tamika Meadows, who sadly, she passed away very suddenly a couple of years ago. And I still go to her blog from time to time. And, you know, my heart sinks because she put together all of these amazing free resources for families. And she was so passionate about elevating that information for communities of color who a lot of times don't have access to that information. So that was really where my autism and ABA journey began. And since then, I mean, this is 4 years ago, I've learned so much. But in the process of doing all of that, one day I was Googling, like, okay, I need to look up, you know, an ABA place near my home that my son can go to. And I put in a bunch of language that I had learned from Dr. Barbera's course. And the first thing that came up was like, Sparks ABA in Springfield, Virginia. And that's how I got in touch with Dr. Genevieve Marshall. And from there, we were, you know, kind of off to the races with my son's journey.
I mean, what bravery that took on your side to be able to say, I'm faced with these challenges. And instead of getting stuck, you really like dove in and said, I'm going to do the research. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to, you know, take this as an opportunity to learn and do all that I can, even during this unprecedented time of things being closed, right? Of things not being available.
Yeah.
And resources not necessarily, they were available online, but not like at your fingerprints or.
Yeah. And I appreciate that. And I would also say that I think a lot of times people will say to caretakers of not just autistic children, but any children or a partner like mine who has some sort of diagnosis that requires a lot of support, they'll say, oh, it's so brave, or I don't know how you do it. And I really believe that anyone in my shoes would have done the same thing, right? Like, we all love our children and our partners and our family members dearly. And I think I have always felt so blessed that I have a lot of privilege in the sense that, you know, I have an amazing family that's always supported me. I have a lot of support through my immediate family, my extended family, my friends. And I'm also very blessed to, you know, to have been in situations in my career where I've had access to lots of information and I know how to do research. And I do have the resources to get the help that I want or that my family needs. And so because I feel that I've been so lucky, one of the things that I'm really passionate about is trying to make those same resources and that same information, really elevating that again in my community and especially in communities of color and underserved communities.
Right. What do you think some of the, I think there, this could be a very broad question, but what are some of the barriers that those communities face in accessing ABA, for example, or other therapies, speech pathology or other therapies? What do you think some of the barriers are for them?
Yeah, I think that is such a good question. And gosh, there's so much to be said on that topic. First of all, I will just say that I think that there are barriers family face across the board, regardless of one's socioeconomic status, their race, their gender, or any other demographic that you want to add. I think there are barriers just across the board. And as a society, we need to do so much better. I mean, I think it needs to start from, honestly, from the federal government, but across the board, like, we need to do better at the federal, state, and local level in getting parents and families the information, the knowledge, the support, and the services that they need. I mean, honestly, I think even doctors, right? Because a lot of times parents, they will first learn about autism or some sort of, you know, red flag, quote unquote, right, through their doctor. And I this is not at all meant to be disrespectful for doctors. I have a tremendous amount of respect for what they've done, especially since the pandemic, being very short-staffed, working long hours in very resource-constrained environments. But I think even doctors, you know, when I first was trying to get my, again, my then two-year-old diagnosed, we knew from the time he was a year and a half that he needed support, that there was some sort of diagnosis there. And I'm telling you, Richie, I went to multiple specialists who said, oh, boys just talk later. You know, like your older daughter, she did everything so early and she's super smart. And, you know, girls are just smarter than boys at that age. And let's just wait and see. Like the wait and see approach, I think, is such a dangerous one. And so I think, like, where is that first touch point for a lot of parents with the world of disability? It's in their doctor's office. So I think first and foremost, like, that can sometimes be the very first barrier. But then beyond that, if I'm speaking particularly from the communities of which I'm a member, like, I'm a first-generation Muslim American. My parents immigrated here from Pakistan. You know, in the South Asian community, in the Muslim community, in a lot of immigrant communities, there's such a lack of understanding of what autism actually is. A lot of people have no idea what it is, and they're afraid that, you know, getting a diagnosis, it's going to be some sort of a sentence. So I think that reluctance and that lack of awareness of what autism is, that's another barrier. What I try to communicate to families in my community, and especially people who reach out to me stating some sort of concern they have about one of their kids, is that an autism diagnosis, it's not going to change who your kid is. They're still going to be the same precious child you love. Now you're just going to be able to make more informed decisions to help them live up to their full God-given potential.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. As you're describing it, the thing that's sticking out to me is this idea of fear, right? I'm afraid of what could come of this. And I think sometimes, you know, parents shy away from things because there's not understanding, but also there's this fear of what if this is true, what else is true, and the ramifications that come from that.
And I'm sorry, I do have to add one more point while we're talking about barriers for communities of color or underserved communities. These are communities that even outside of a diagnosis, they are still marginalized in society. They face xenophobia, racism, discrimination when they go to doctor's offices, in their employment, in schools, etc. And especially in immigrant communities, I can't tell you how many mothers I've spoken to who are actually trying to do the right thing, but they're just afraid to ask questions. They're afraid to question the professional. They feel like they have to do whatever the professional is telling them, or that if someone is saying your child should do, you know, ABA or speech therapy a certain way, and they have their own idea based on their family circumstances, they're afraid to voice that. So I think that is another big barrier. Like, how can we empower these parents and these families and communities to really feel like they can advocate for their children? And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you can ask questions and you can push back.
I think not only can you, but you should, right? I would say this a lot when I was practicing and seeing families regularly. I will never know your child as well as you do, right? I may know ABA and I may know the science, but I don't know your family culture. What are your priorities? What is important to you and your child? What it's like at 2 a.m. I'm not going to be there at 2 in the morning, right? What's happening at that time and how can we help with that without being there? And I think those are some of the conversations that I want people to feel empowered to have. But I think you're right. You've got to be able to, like, as a society, we've got to allow for those conversations to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, part of the problem, and forgive me now if I'm veering into something more controversial, but I think part of the problem is that the reality is bad ABA does exist. I feel very, very blessed that Sparks ABA was the first place I found. And my experience with Sparks ABA and Learn Behavioral has been nothing short of phenomenal. I mean, I consider the people that my sons have worked with a part of my family. I tell people at Sparks all the time that when my younger son, who's still in ABA, and I think he probably will be for maybe the next year and a half or so, and then I'm hoping that he will have, gained the skills he needs to thrive in school. I always tell them, look, right now, I know my kids are clients, but when that's not an issue, I want to come back and be some sort of a community advocate. I think what makes Sparks and Learn Behavioral so amazing is that it's contemporary ABA, which I wish I could have a microphone and have the opportunity to engage with people, including autistic adults. I want to state up front, I think it's extremely important that these conversations are always led and centered around autistic individuals. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's important that the reality is that autism is a spectrum. And for many autistic individuals, many autistic kids, their caretakers, like myself, the parents, or whoever it may be, we are going to be on a lifelong journey. So how can we not be a part of the conversation? Why should our voices be dismissed? And why should I constantly have to qualify that I do, in fact, love my children? My love for my children is what has driven me to this point, because I want them to have a fighting chance in this world. So I wanna state that up front before continuing this discussion on ABA. But going back to Sparks and Learn Behavioral, again, it's contemporary, ascent-based, very positive ABA. So, concrete examples I give to parents who are questioning, should I, shouldn't I? Because as you know, Richie, there are a lot of very, very loud voices against ABA.
Online, I think now more than ever.
Yeah, and it is a truly overwhelming time to be a parent on social media these days. But concrete examples I will give parents is, things we are working on or have worked on with my boys is helping them communicate their needs, helping with things that I want them to know how to do. Because if, God forbid, I'm not here one day, I want them to know how to put on their clothes, how to, functionally use the bathroom, how to brush their teeth, how to do things like cut a strawberry, make a sandwich for themselves, how to think of all the day-to-day things that you do that for people like you and me, Richie, they came to us naturally without a thought. But for many autistic individuals, they have to work so hard to gain those skills. I have never, in my more than 4 years with Sparks now, ever had an experience where someone forced my kids to engage in eye contact, or someone punished my kids, or they forced them to behave a certain way. Absolutely not. And if that were to ever happen, I would certainly raise my voice immediately. Like, Sparks knows me. They know that I am a very engaged parent and I give them feedback all the time. But thank God, I have never had that experience. Unfortunately, though, a lot of parents, they have had those experiences. And I think, you know, I think especially for families who are newer to this world, they also may not realize that this is a really hard time. And I think it's like a time of transformation right now within the ABA world. You all are, first of all, you're extremely short-staffed. There aren't enough professionals, and the diagnosis rates, they keep increasing. And then on top of all of that, you're trying to operate in this sea of just like vitriol that is extremely anti-ABA.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, one of the things that I'm hearing from you is, gosh, I definitely hear the research piece that you've spent time doing, right? This idea between contemporary ABA versus traditional ABA, or what I would call traditional ABA for lack of a better term. I think, gosh, when you look into the history of how things have happened, you're right. There are a lot of families who have not had the contemporary play-based, ascent-based approach to therapy. And I think that's been a big shift over the last couple of years, really the last decade, certainly for us, but also for the community. And I think it's a good shift. But I do think that, like, now there's a little bit of the conversation of this is what it was, which is a valid part of the conversation. And I don't want to dismiss it or not give it the attention that it deserves. But also I want people to focus on the changes that have come from that and be aware of how things have changed and have improved, because I don't want that to get lost in this either, because then you've got families who are getting a diagnosis and they have a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old and they just don't know where to go and they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And they're seeing this online, but then they're hearing this other side. So there's a balance.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, I'm in so many groups online, groups that are led by autistic individuals, groups that are catered more towards caretakers. And it's always an ongoing debate, even amongst parents. I mean, I have spoken to many parents who are like, we tried ABA and they tried to force XYZ. And this goes back to the earlier point, Richie, which is parents need to feel empowered, like give ABA a chance. If it's not what you're expecting, or if it's not meeting your child's needs, then voice your concern, because you know what? A lot of times the ABA, whether it's the technicians, the BCBAs, they're going to be willing to hear your feedback. And if they're not, then that's where you do, as a parent or caretaker, you have to decide, okay, maybe I need to go somewhere else, or maybe I need to escalate this conversation within the company, because at the end of the day, we're all trying to do what's best for our kids, right? But I think, again, that's why this point of empowering parents to speak up, it's so important.
Arfa, I want to ask you a question about dignity and adult life for your boys, and what your thought is on that. And we've talked a little bit about how society needs to get ready for this upcoming group of individuals with autism, and how they need to get ready for society as a whole. But what would be your goal for your boys as they grow up and grow into adulthood?
Yeah, my goal for my boys is I want them to be as happy first and foremost. I want them to be as happy and as healthy and as independent as possible, which is frankly, I think, what every parent ever wants for their children in any country in the world, right? Like that is what I want for each one of my children, whether it's my two autistic boys or my neurotypical daughter. I want all three of them to be happy, healthy, independent. And I want all three of them to have, again, a fighting chance to live up to their potential, to have opportunities and options. So for me, what that means, I mean, right now I am focused very much on their school age years. Because I do think while, yes, it's important that parents plan for the long term, especially financially, I also think that I wouldn't sleep at night if I spent my days worrying about the future. So right now we take it literally one day at a time. And I'm always thinking about like the next year, maybe the next couple of years. So right now, my immediate attention, it's on their success in school. Mm. But going back to your question, I mean, beyond my goal of them being happy, healthy, and independent, what that I hope would practically look like is that number one, my boys are still little, and there is, I think, more awareness in society and especially in the workplace than there ever has been around autism and neurodivergence. We still have a long way to go. But what I would love to see happen in our lifetime, and what I am always, you know, beating the drum for, is it should not be on just my boys to learn how to operate in your neurotypical world. You know, society needs to take a step into the world of different abilities too. So, and I think, you know, again, professionally in my work life, that is something I try to advocate for. I encourage my neurotypical friends and family members who have kids to think about the way they're raising their children through that lens. But this is truly a society-wide effort. So we need to, again, think about whether it's in school, whether it's at work, whether it's in your church, your mosque, your temple, at the grocery store. Yeah, all the community spaces. We need to stop putting the onus on differently abled people to spend literally years and years and years learning how to live with us. We live with them. And so we need to start taking steps into their world. That is, you know, that's a very large undertaking. But I mean, that's the hill I will die on. Like, that is something I will advocate for my entire life. And then in terms of other more concrete goals, I want my sons, look, I will be honest, like any parent, I hope that they will be able to continue their education once they're adults, whatever that looks like, you know, whether it's community college or a college or university, or it's something else. And I hope that they will be able to find something that interests them and hopefully make a living doing that. You know, what we may say as an autistic individual who requires lesser supports, right? Mm-hmm. And has finished kind of a traditional path of education. They usually end up in fields like IT. And I think there should be more options in that. Wow. On the flip side, for autistic individuals who maybe do not end up completing those traditional education paths and may require a higher level of supports, there should, again, still be more options for them to engage in some sort of work life with dignity, right? And then beyond just work life, if we're just talking about, you know, their social life and living itself, I think we have such a ways to go. I mean, yep. Our autistic, the members of our community who are autistic, our autistic children and our brothers and sisters, our neighbors, our community members, they deserve so much more than feeling them and their families, especially for the individuals who require higher supports,
right,
that they're resigned to just like being put up in homes that sometimes don't do a great job of taking care of those individuals and supporting them after the family has passed on.
Or they end up doing menial tasks at jobs that are not necessarily challenging to them or inspiring to them or invigorating, and they go through the motions of doing the work because that's kind of what's available, right?
Right. Yeah. And
I think there are a lot more options than that.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that's, I wanted to make that point and I forgot. But that's such an important point, Richie. I mean, to this day, I see that with my twin sister. In many ways, the older we've gotten, the more I see how starkly our lives have diverged from the journey that started in the womb, yeah, just because she was born deaf. And I mean, I do this for my kids, but my sister Ikra, she was the first person who formed my heart and my brain in this way around these topics. And she deserves so much more than the opportunities she's been given in this life. And Richie, even before I got on this call with you, I was trying to get a hold of someone on behalf of my sister regarding a program that she wants to get into. So we need to do so much better.
Yeah, yeah.
Because right now, what I say to people is like, look, you need to give a damn. Because if you do not know someone right now who isn't impacted by autism, you will in the future. You will.
Yep.
You absolutely will. Because if you look at the diagnosis rates and just look at the numbers, you are going to know neurodivergent and differently abled people in your lifetime. And I do, you know, I do believe that at the end of the day, as polarized and divided as our country is, when it comes to our kids, especially, I think like when you bring a group of caretakers for differently abled children to a table, suddenly all of those things that polarize us and divide us, they kind of go out the window. And so I think we need to like really remember our shared humanity and interconnectedness with each other, find the common ground and figure out like how we move as a society to inclusivity with dignity.
I can't think of a more powerful statement than that, Arfa. I think that that's an excellent call to action for people. Get out, you know, get into the world, be in touch with those who may need different things than what we're used to, right? Be a part of the community and connect to the community in a different way than maybe we're used to. I think that's a great call to action and a great challenge for the people who aren't doing that. So thank you so much for that. And thank you for your time today. I appreciate your time and your insight. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me as You can tell I love talking about these things. I'm extremely passionate, and I would love to come back and continue the conversation if you'll have me again.
Absolutely. Yeah, we need to have this conversation. This is not a one and done, I think, for our community and our society as a whole. I think this is something that needs to continue and evolve as the world around us evolves.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again, Richie, for having me. Really enjoyed this.
I hope you appreciated that conversation with Arfa as much as I did. A couple of things that really stood out to me were, one, her goal of having happy, healthy, independent children. I think that's something that really resonated with me as a parent, and is something that I think resonates with a lot of people all across the world. The other thing that I really appreciated was her perspective on not only how we prepare our children for the world, but how we prepare the world for our children. And I think she does a great job of sharing some of the barriers that families face, but also some of the optimism that comes along with providing the therapy and providing an inclusive environment. I think those two things have to coexist in order for our aging autism population to be fully inclusive and achieve an adult life with dignity, which I think is one of the things that she really highlights. You can always find us on Facebook and Instagram at Autism Therapies. And if you have a show suggestion or other feedback, please feel free to send us a message at our website at allautismtalk.com. You can subscribe, rate, and review us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, take care.
We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of All Autism Talk. This podcast is brought to you by Learn Behavioral, the leading network of providers serving children with autism and other special needs. Visit us at learnbehavioral.com. Listen to previous episodes at allautismtalk.com, on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. All Autism Talk, connecting the autism community one podcast at a time.